Good morning, everyone. I would like to continue yesterday's work session for those members of the public who are here. We have a few items to complete from yesterday's work session before we begin the business session. At the conclusion of the work session, we'll take our normally scheduled public comment. We're going to pick up where we left off, which is item 13A, which is the status and update on the V-Trans 2035. Mr. Davis, not Dr. Davis, but Mr. Davis, I did want to acknowledge on behalf of the entire CTB, as we have done with Mary Lynn, there's been an enormous amount of work over many years in a very, very tough environment, and I know all of us appreciate that planning is actually the most contentious thing we do. We do a pretty good job making hard financial decisions, but when you talk about competing visions, about establishing priorities, you know, that manage the Commonwealth for 40, 50 years, that these are important issues, and it should be spirited and difficult debate, and you have managed to bring us through that, and we're getting to the conclusion of a very important process. So I know all of us want to say thank you, Ralph.
Thank you.
Pleased to hear your update, and next month, the adoption of the V-Trans 2035 document.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Today's presentation is a follow-on to yesterday's presentation in terms of where we are with V-Trans and what's left to do. Yesterday, you heard about the corridors of statewide significance and the key investment priorities. Once we get beyond that is how do we move forward with these recommendations? And that's some of what I'd like to talk to you about today. All of V-Trans you've seen variations of, with the conclusions yesterday in terms of what I think are the core products out of V-Trans. The other products is what do we do now and how do we go forward? And these first several bullets under moving the corridors and priorities forward are some things that I would recommend you will find in the final document in terms of how do we move forward. One of those things is to maintain office of intermodal planning. As most of you know, I serve as director in addition to my responsibilities as deputy secretary, as director of this office of intermodal planning and investment. And there are some major responsibilities for this office, a lot of which were assigned with law changes in 2009. And it's going to be important that this particular function continues with the transition of the administration. One thing that I recommend is that at least someone at the deputy secretary level would be assigned as director of this particular office. There's also need for continuity. One of the issues that we have is doing changes in administrations. If you have only at-will appointees in these kind of jobs, you need to be able to transition across administrations. And that's one of the issues I think we're going to face is we need a career bureaucrat at a very high level who can continue with V-Trans kinds of activities during the transition across administrations. As some of you know, there is a separate multimodal fund. It's about $4 million. Those funds are used for things such as the long-range plan. We fund things, long-range plan. We've done land use kinds of studies. My recommendation is that that fund would be continued. One of the learning lessons that I've had over the last 7 or 8 years is the need for a planning policy committee, much like the subcommittee that was set up over the last month or so. There needs to be champions within the CTB for planning types of activities. With V-Trans 2025, we had several champions. We had Ms. Connolly, who 2025 was like her baby, and she would not let it be hurt. We had Mr. McCarthy, who insisted on investing in transportation as one of our key initiatives. So some of what we need is to make sure that we have a policy committee consisting of CTB members who can follow the V-Trans and champion it throughout the year. It should be a standing committee, my recommendation, and it should also consist of board members from, say, the Port Authority. V-Trans is not just about highways, but it's about multimodal, so you should have at least a member from the Virginia Port Authority Board of Commissioners and the Aviation Board. So you get the multimodal kinds of feel as these projects move forward. We have within V-Trans and what's called a multimodal advisory committee. And this committee consists of staff that not only are from the modal agencies, but also staff from the planning district commissions. This brings in the need for us to not only communicate at the state level, but also communicate with the locals as well. Another recommendation is that we need to align the planning effort with governor's terms. The law requires that our plans be done every 5 years. For the upcoming administration, there will be no long-range plan unless some actions are taken to do it, because it does not do it until five years after this year. So there will be no long-range plan unless you separately take action and say we want a plan done. I think there's a need for these things to probably be done on every 4 years, probably towards the end of a governor's administration, probably a year or so out, so that he can put in place his plan for transportation. So there's the issue of how do you transition across administrations? And as I said, next year there will not be, for the next administration, unless something changed, there's no long-range plan. We have made a series of recommendations for V-Trans 2025. There needs to be an action plan that's developed probably over the next 6 months that deals with the recommendations that are made in V-Trans. There are requirements regarding the corridors. There's requirements regarding studies of each of those corridors, so a plan needs to be put together over the next 6 months or so, or sooner, to implement the recommendations of V-Trans 2035. There's another element of V-Trans 2035 that we do not talk a lot about, and that's called the Surface Transportation Plan. What that is each of the modal agencies develop their own modal plans, and these plans are stepped below V-Trans 2035. They are the actual projects. V-Trans deals with mega kind of projects and priorities and corridors, but to get below those mega projects are actual projects that either DRPT does in terms of transit or in terms of rail, or VDOT may do in terms of highways. One of the things we've tried to do is historically these plans have been separate. There's been a rail plan, a transit plan, and a VDOT plan. And one of our key pushes this time is to pull those two agencies together in terms of one plan with projects in them, and this is called the Surface Transportation Plan. They basically use a series of measures in terms of how to develop these projects, and where this thing comes in, if there is money available, this can help you in terms of what may be some of the projects below these mega projects. As you're looking at improvements, there are a series of sub-projects that these modal agencies have done. So that's a companion piece to V-Trans 2035, and it's more detailed. It goes to the next level, below the mega projects, and below the corridors, and so forth. We recommend that process continue. It's we've moved from these modal stovepipes, not quite. But we need to continue moving in the direction. When we plan, it's not about VDOT, it's not about DRBT, it's about the whole surface transportation issue. So that's kind of what's involved in the surface transportation plan being developed with V-Trans. In terms of a timeline, we are drafting a report based on the guidance that we've received from the subcommittee. My hope is that over the next couple of days of the weekend, we will have a draft of that report. We will make that report available to you, to the governor. We do have to make that information available to the public as well. We're hoping that we have a draft available that's being reviewed and finalize that report in the December timeframe. I would plan to report back to you at the December workshop, and I have to figure out exactly what that is. You've heard most of what's in V-Trans 2035. Hopefully to get a resolution to approve the report in December and provide the report to the governor. Mr. Chair, that's my summary of where we are and where we need to go. Would be pleased to entertain any questions.
Questions or comments? Mr. Davis.
Thanks, sir. Whose responsibility is it to, or whose duty is it to make these recommendations, carry them forward, to put them in action? Is that ours, or is that the administration's?
I think it would be appropriate for
some of these for the CTB to do a resolution, obviously would need to be considered by the new administration. I do think probably the most important one in there is the recommendation is to synchronize this a little bit better with the term of office. The original thinking was a five-year planning period, which is what localities have to do with their comprehensive plans, would insulate it from politics. It is such an opportunity, particularly in the early, say, in the first 6 to 12 months of an administration to lay out a blueprint, but have some. It's also an opportunity for some continuity. As we know in our business, continuity is very important for these projects that stretch out over 10 and 20 years. So if it's the wish of the board, we could have an action item expressing the sense of the CTB on these major planning issues at our next next meeting, if that's okay with folks. On is there any disagreement with any of the recommendations? Okay.
Thank you very much.
If we could
stretch
that for an action item in December, would be great.
We'll do. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go back up to item 7, which is the rail industrial access Whiting Road, and a second item also what Mr. Page from the Department of Rail and Public Transportation is the Southeast High Speed Rail Project. Welcome, Mr. Page.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I have two items on the agenda today. The first is a rail industrial access program briefing. I want to advise the board that we'll be coming back to you in your formal meeting today with a resolution for action on this proposal, and I'll explain the reason for that in just a second. The Whiting Road LLC Frederick County site is around the Route 1137 interchange. It's a somewhat industrialized area of Winchester, and this location fits very well to another transload location that's due north of here, at the 1137 interchange on the north side of town, which is operated by UMS Transfer and Storage. What we found in working with businesses in this area, like Trex Manufacturing, for example, which is right up the road from the site location, is that they require very heavily on rail, but they do not have the ability for direct rail access. So what we found is a market for intermodal development for transload facilities in this area has worked very well for our small industries to locate a little bit further away from the railhead and then transload their goods and inbound and outbound goods by rail with a short-haul truck and be able to do business there. This project will be operated by Allied Millwork and Allied Systems Corporations. It will be an open for business facility, but the main emphasis of this project and the rail cars that are dedicated to it are actually operated and dedicated from Allied Millwork. Allied in Annandale is a company that builds business wall components and also residential homes, very similar to how Syntex and other companies will assemble houses on site in 10 days. These wall systems are actually manufactured off site at a place that Annandale operates in Winchester. This is a $505,000 project, a rail project that is. It's a $3.3 million project, and Whiting Road has requested acceleration approval because they want to get started before the winter season sets in up in Frederick County. The local capital investment, again, is $3.3 million. The rail access project, although it only creates two jobs for the transload facility, which we usually find to be very low in employment, it does have that spillover, as I was mentioning earlier, because of the availability to all of the industries in the area. This rail access that's been put forward is a 500 shipment project at about 1,500 to 2,000 truckloads per year, depending on the commodity as to whether we get three or four trucks in a rail car. The evaluation of the project, as you see every month we come to you, is set forth for reference. Whiting Road has requested of the $505,000, $400,000 for recommended approval today from the department, and that will require $105,000 private match from Whiting Road. I'm happy to turn the presentation back over to you, Mr. Chairman, for any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Page?
The project.
Obviously. Thank you. The next item is the update on the Southeast High Speed Rail project, and I believe there is an action item on today's agenda for that. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, it is, and I'm trying to locate that. Here it is. Okay.
This is action item 12 under your business agenda.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Before I get started, I want to explain this is a routine project that has been ongoing since 2007, and we're coming back to the board today to continue the work that I'm going to give you an overview on the Southeast High Speed Rail Corridor south of Richmond. I just want to reflect back, if I may, to the Commonwealth Transportation Board about our high-speed rail priorities that we are undergoing today in Virginia, as also guided by funding that's been provided through programming of the board before us. Our first priority is the I-95 corridor between Washington and Richmond. Our second priority here in Virginia is very important as to how we will extend that high-speed rail corridor to Hampton Roads. That is our number two priority that we are working forward as we speak today, and we hope to get that environmental impact statement out very soon. The Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor Tier 2 Environmental Impact Statement is the one we're going to talk about today. That's our third tier of priority, and again, we're continuing to work to move forward on this project as well. One of the most important things about the high-speed corridor south of Richmond is that it also has sections of track that will achieve up to 110 miles per hour, which requires the roads to either be below the railroad or above the railroad. This project that we're bringing forward today for this contract that we're going to be talking about started in 2007, a relationship between NCDOT and VDOT, because it's very important that VDOT be a party at the table in the review and design of these bridge structures that will either go over or under the railroad for highway improvements. So it's very important that we have the Richmond District at the table and VDOT in that bridge design and review. However, there is a cost associated with that. Through the negotiations, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we've been able to reimburse back to VDOT through the NCDOT agreement the cost of those design reviews, very similar to how VDOT will also charge other interest in highway improvements as they move forward in those reviews. We are nearing completion of the Tier 2 environmental statement. We have more work yet to do. What this resolution does is sets the strategy forward and authorizes the Commissioner of VDOT to continue this process as we move very quickly. Remember now, we're putting resolutions and agreements in place, so if in fact stimulus funds do become available, we are ready to go and move forward as quickly as possible. In saying that, this resolution puts forth that strategy, and DRPT recommends to this board that we continue the process between NCDOT and VDOT to move forward the appropriate design of these structures and facilities and have VDOT at the table as we move forward. The formal resolution will be presented to you later today, and we'll certainly be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman, at this time.
Questions, Ms. Page?
Just a quick informational. Describe for me the difference between the Tier 1 and the Tier 2.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Dickens has asked for some clarification about the difference between Tier 1 and Tier 2 environmental impact statements. Tier 1 actually will work to select the route in the corridor. Tier 2, what that is it takes that overarching programmatic document and starts to better refine where that actual track, for example, is going to sit within that routing. And then from that strategy forward, you go to the next granularity where you identify environmental impacts, processes and procedures to mitigate those impacts, and also move forward with preliminary and final design of those projects. That gets you to the construction implementation at that time.
And comment, if I may, I heard second-handed from somebody that was with a number of our congressional delegation recently in discussions with where the high-speed rail money is going to go. And the comment was from the Virginia delegation that Virginia is not working closely enough with neighboring states, which could have an adverse impact on our getting money. I don't know whether that's right, wrong, or indifferent. Apparently, it's not altogether right. But the point is, if our delegation is perceiving that, then maybe somebody else is, and we ought to do something to counter that. So for whatever that's worth.
Okay. And I think it's worth noting, again, when you hear those types of comments, to indicate that Governor Kane and Governor Perdue met. They synchronized the applications for high-speed rail between North Carolina and Virginia. There's strong interest in Georgia. I think South Carolina is still a little bit of a question. Now, that may be part of the mix, and that would be a legitimate question, but as far as our neighboring states in the District of Columbia, Maryland, North Carolina, very close consolidated collaboration. In fact, this is kind of an interesting process where we're taking money through North Carolina to look at improvements in Virginia. There's a similar relationship with the District of Columbia in order to accommodate those interests as well. But that's a very good heads up. Okay, any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Page.
Thank you, sir.
Let's turn then to work session item 9 on I-73, and Mr. Walton will be standing in for Mr. Kaywood, the Salem District Administrator, on this topic. We're continuing our tradition of important long-range planning decision. If you think about it, this agenda between V-Trans, Route 29, I-73, and Route 460, there's some very, very important issues before us yesterday and today. Welcome, Mr. Walton.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. Mr. Kaywood sends his regrets. He had a family illness and was not able to make it and asked if I would sub for him. And going back to last summer, the board received a request from Henry County that the board consider an alternate route through the Henry County Martinsville area for I-73. And in June of last year, the board passed a resolution asking that the department, working with Federal Highways, do a somewhat preliminary study of this alternate route. That study was submitted to you in your board package. I hope you've had an opportunity to review it, and I will be going through today just a little history of this project as well as the study itself. Okay. Okay, Carol, each one of these. I got it. As far as I-73 from a national perspective, it was identified by the Congress as a high priority corridor and identified in 1991 as part of ICE-T. It was basically a corridor north of Detroit to Charleston, South Carolina, and in 1993 VDOT launched a feasibility study for the portion of I-73 running from Roanoke to the North Carolina line. As far as the environmental study, a draft EIS began in 1997. It was completed in 2006. It looked at a number of potential corridors for this new interstate. We received thousands of public comments about the potential corridor. As you can see, it was a rather voluminous, final EIS, not including the various technical studies that went into the finding. And we worked with a number of federal regulatory agencies in moving this process forward. To the left, the somewhat spaghetti map you see there, through the public involvement process, were various alignments that were initially suggested and reviewed. The larger picture on the right were the final alternatives that were included in the draft EIS. In 2001, VDOT staff recommended an alignment to the Transportation Board that actually ran to the west of the city of Martinsville, using a large portion of the existing 220-58 corridor. Our reason for that, just a statement from the staff recommendation, there were fewer impacts, both environmental and social, but also a significant cost savings. $106 million less than the eventual alignment that was selected running east of Martinsville. In May, the CTB did approve an alignment, not what staff had recommended, but one that ran to the east of Martinsville. There were a number of concerns raised by Danville and others, to the east of Martinsville that the alignment needed to be in that eastern corridor in order to also serve the interests of the Danville area. In June, the May resolution was rescinded 1 month later, and another alignment, this one moving a little bit further to the east, again, all along alignments that had been part of the draft environmental impact statement study, was approved by the Transportation Board. None of these were unanimous decisions. There was a lot of, debate and dissent as to where this alignment should go. But the June 21st alignment is the one that we have been dealing with up to this point in time until we got the request from Henry County. Here's just a map showing the various alignments that have been presented to the CTB since the conclusion of the environmental document. One more change in 2004, not in the Martinsville area, but actually up in the Roanoke area, when the keeper of the National Register of Historic Places determined that the Southeast Roanoke Neighborhood District was eligible for inclusion in the National Register of Historic Places. And based on that determination, there was a slight alignment shift in that area. Which brings us to the more recent history on this. The Record of Decision was issued in March of 2007. There was a lawsuit filed for plaintiffs over the Interstate 73 project in October of 2007. The court finally heard the case in May of 2009, and in August, summary judgment was granted for the defendants in the case, which were the Federal Highway Administration and VDOT, on the environmental document. The environmental document was in accordance with the National Environmental Policy Act. An appeal has been filed by the plaintiffs in October, and they have also filed a separate motion in the Fourth Circuit to hold the whole lawsuit in abeyance, arguing primarily there's no money to build it, so why do we need to have a decision? The same argument was made in the U.S. District Court. Judge Turk denied that motion for numerous reasons. We were hoping that the Fourth Circuit will deny it for the same reasons because, as we all know, we need finality of certain decisions to move the process along.
Mr. Walton, I'm not familiar with the lawsuit. Does it challenge any particular alignment, or is it, is it related at all to the issue that Henry County's raised?
Who's raised?
The lawsuit, the Henry County's request.
No, the lawsuit is, I call it your standard NEPA lawsuit. We didn't look at alternatives we should have looked at, the court said, that we took a hard look at reasonable alternatives, which is all we're required to do.
Thank you.
But because of the litigation, a lot of work, on this project has been temporarily suspended until there's a final resolution. As you can see in the rest of this slide, the amount of money that has been spent to date and the amount of money that is remaining primarily in two earmarks, one in the Roanoke area and one in the Martinsville area. This is a map showing the alternative alignment which was suggested by Henry County that the board asked us to look at in June of last year. To the right or to the west is the existing alignment. The blue alignment to the east is the one that Henry County asked us to study. Again, this is just, citing the resolution that the board adopted in June. We engaged the engineering firm of Parsons Brinkerhoff to evaluate the alternative. It was an iterative and cooperative process. There was a lot of back and forth. There was a draft. There were some concerns with the original alignment that Henry County had proposed, and there were some shifts made because of those concerns. Here's a drawing showing the two areas that there were some shifts because of concerns. In the southern section, the primary concern was that the alignment would have basically bisected a 4F property, a park. Clearly, federal law requires us to avoid 4F property at all, not at all costs, but that we should avoid it. So because of that, we worked with Henry County and moving the alignment so that not to impact this 4F property. As far as the report itself, what Parsons Brinkerhoff found as far as enhancements to the alignment that Henry County was proposing is that it does bring the location, of the project closer to the economic activity associated with the Patriot Center in the Martinsville Motor Speedway. The Patriot Center is I don't know if it's an industrial park, and there's people from an industrial park that Martinsville is developing, and that this would bring that facility closer to that industrial center. There is a reduction in wetlands. It's very positive. Five fewer stream crossings. Two fewer commercial property impacts. Now, the detriments that the report identified, there's a higher capital cost to this facility, primarily because it's longer. It's almost 2 miles longer than the alternative that was selected previously. As you can see, it's 1.8 miles. There are 38 additional residential relocations. There's an environmental justice concern because the residential relocations are at the interchange of the project with Route 58, and there's a trailer park there with low-income residents. There is an increase of acreage with floodplain impacts. There's also a concern with the proximity to a school, with the noise impacts to the school, and also proximity to the Beaver Creek Martinsville Reservoir. As far as the cost and risk that staff has looked at, obviously there's a cost if we were to reopen the record and consider another, you know, alternative. We're looking at a low end of about $500,000 up to a high end of a little over $2 million, depending on what study FHWA would require us to make. The estimated time ranges from 12 months to 30 months, and I can't tell you anything more than that until the board decides what it wants to do. We approach Federal Highways, and then Federal Highways, you know, determines what sort of study will be required. Again, on as far as risk, there's no guarantee that the alternate route that the board should select, if it selects that alternate route to be studied, will be accepted by FHWA. Environmental justice concerns, some other concerns, they may say, no, we're not going with that. The one you had previously was fine. We didn't have environmental justice concerns. There may be other 4F issues. We just don't know right now based on the preliminary study that's been undertaken. It obviously would give parties who are opposed to the project another opportunity to file litigation or initiate litigation against the project, which again could delay anything being built in that corridor. So the options. The first option is not to take any action, to stay with the corridor that's been selected, you know, by the CTB, continue to pursue that project, start to do, you know, go through with, you know, finish the lawsuit. Hopefully we're successful in the Fourth Circuit, begin some preliminary engineering work along that alignment. Option two is to take action to go forward and do additional work on the alternative route, and, you know, take that through whatever environmental process that FHWA may require. Here's again just a comparison of the two routes and what's been done previously. VDOT's recommendation is option one, to stay with the alignment that was selected by the board previously, the one that has been subject to the litigation and the one that, you know, is being studied. And actually, if the board were to decide to reopen it, it would be staff's recommendation to go back to what staff recommended previously, is to go to the west of Martinsville and to use the existing 220 58 corridor because of the less costs and less environmental and social impacts of using that existing corridor. That's the presentation. I will be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions or comments? I do know under citizens' time we'll be hearing from some individuals from the Martinsville area. Mr. Martin, did you have any?
Yes, I have some more comments and questions. If anyone had questions, I would defer to them to ask their questions first.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman. And looking at the various maps, we can't quite compare the alternatives in terms of actual mileage, but it looks like how close is the proposed new alignment to the speedway? Is it right next to it? Is it?
I would defer to the people. There are people here from Martinsville that may be able to give you a better answer.
And this, much closer. The second question was, though, is the western alignment, it looks like, best I can say, it might be a mile away. A mile away, is that about right?
Okay. Mr. Martin.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is almost certainly going to include the big but. And that refers to when someone has said something and then the but comes along. And I must start with the report that we have heard is honorable, factual, sincere. Everything you've heard is correct. And now the big but. It's correctness does not always equate to rightness. Reasonable people looking at the same facts can come to different conclusions, and that is what has happened this time. In the interest of getting out sometime before lunch, I've got going to go item by item, which I could do. Make no mistake about it. You know, various things which basically would end up inconsequential to the bottom line. The bottom line here is for the amount of money that we are talking about spending, and indeed the Henry County alignment is actually less cost per mile. If I wanted to play the, you know what they say about statistics, if I wanted to do that, I could say that, well, under the existing alignment, you're spending roughly $77,000 or $57,000 million a mile. And to change to Henry County, you get two more miles and five interchanges for $77 million, which is a bit of sophism there. But the bottom line is the alignment, while incrementally more expensive, is a much bigger bang for the buck. And that bang for the buck extends into both the intangibles and the economic tangibles. If we're going to spend this amount of money, then there are two places that need to benefit from it in Martinsville, Henry County. You all, few of you are probably race fans, and fewer still of you deal with communities where you have lost your economy over the last couple of decades, where your citizens are day-to-day wondering what is next. Henry County has lost textiles to its economic base. They have lost furniture to their economic base. NASCAR has stuck by them. And for what good it does, those two races bring in a tremendous amount of money each year. Arguably, they have been the savior of Henry County. Those two races. Losing one of those dates could be precipitated by something like fans continually having problems getting there. And traffic like some of you deal with in Northern Virginia every day. NASCAR is the past, the track is the past. It is the sole proven economic engine that that area has left. The Patriot Center, on the other hand, is the one, arguably, the only successful venture into the future for Henry County and the region to adjust and do what it has to do for future economic viability, to replace the textiles, to replace the furniture. If we're going to spend the money, then we need to include those places, and it doesn't cost that much more, and it is a much better expenditure for the dollar. People have approached me over the years and said things like, well, you know, if you use existing highway, it's got to be cheaper. And they were shocked when they found out using the existing bypass, or at least using 5 miles of the existing bypass, how in the world could that be more expensive? Well, logically, I understood how it could be, and it doesn't change the fact that it's only an incremental amount, and as far as environmental issues go, as EPA, I know they can do some strange things, but it's totally beyond the realm of sanity that they're going to find more environmental issues using 5 miles of existing roads than they're going to find using 3 miles of new highway. And various other things like that. But the bottom line is, what Henry County is asking for, and I'm going to offer a motion under new business today in support of it, is the right thing to do. And it does not cost us anything, or it does not expose us to anything that we're not exposed to anyway. And I'll ask you to help me this afternoon to augment what people have done with the correct thing with us adding on the right thing.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of questions. One is to follow up where Mr. Coulombe was, and I'm having a hard time determining what, under the proposed Henry County alignment, Does it go right to the front door of the Speedway and the Patriot Center? Or is there some connector there? I can't tell from the maps. And then my second question relates to the reservoir and what are the issues and the distance from that reservoir on the proposed alignment?
I'm Bruce McAuliffe with L&D. I'm project manager on I-73. The new Henry County alignment goes right through the Patriot Center, the new proposed Patriot Center, and they propose an interchange right in the Patriot Center. As far as the reservoir, it does cross the reservoir, the very upstream drainage of the reservoir. But then again, the approved alignment does too, but it's a mile further up the drainage.
What sort of crossing is
that? It will be a bridge. Of some kind.
I mean, are the costs of the bridge different depending on where it crosses, or is it major?
Would be
the major concern there is the environmental one.
The major concern is the environmental issue.
So the bridge cost is real. It's not a bigger bridge, or
it would be a bigger bridge. Yeah. I mean, the reservoir is wider there, so the bridge would be longer. As far as the Patriot Center, neither of the alternatives goes through the. Excuse me. As far as the speedway, neither of the alternatives go through the speedway. The Henry County alignment does come closer to the speedway than the approved alignment.
Mr. Chairman, I have one more question. How far is it to the speedway on the Henry County proposal, and how do you get there?
You would go down 58. There would be a new alignment. Can you put the map up? The more detailed Henry County alignment.
That one.
Yeah.
The blue is the alignment. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see here where the speedway is, that dot, and you would come down, you would get off of the approved alignment and get on to 58 and access it as you normally would, as you do today.
And the blue is the Henry County one on that map, or is the red
no.
the Henry County one?
It's not here.
One final question, Mr. Chairman, I apologize. On the Patriot Center or on the Speedway, has there been any discussion with those private parties as to providing any supplemental funding for making that direct access?
No.
As a follow-up Elaine, question, I'm sorry.
We do have a busy agenda, folks.
Sorry. As a follow-up question to that, I am a NASCAR fan. So has NASCAR weighed in any part of this process or giving any type of not only recommendation but ultimatum in terms of the enhancements in any way?
Not to us yet. That would be part of the next process.
Mr. Chairman, being in Bristol, we're exposed to a little community of 50,000 people overwhelmed by 160,000 paid admissions to a NASCAR race twice a year. It's a tremendous boost to the local economy, but it's a horrible nightmare getting the traffic in and getting it out. Putting an interstate closer to the speedway would greatly facilitate the flow of that traffic in and out.
Okay. Under new business, Mr. Martin is going to request a specific resolution for the December CTB meeting. We will expose, this will provide an opportunity for the county and other interested groups to provide commentary. The chair would observe that transportation is intended to serve and promote the quality of life in a community, and that includes economic vitality. And there are issues sometimes where you got to make these kinds of qualitative decisions, may not show up on a spreadsheet, but that are very important. And I do think we need to give great deference to a community that is struggling with over 20% unemployment and trying to remake and rebuild itself. We will be hearing from the county administrator under citizens' time, and we'll have an opportunity to look at this specifically as an action item in December. Okay? All right, the next item, yet another location and approval, long-range planning study for the phase two of the Route 460 connector in the Bristol District. Ken Brittle, the ABLE acting administrator, district administrator. Welcome, Mr. Brittle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to be here. from the great far southwest. Uh, 460 has been mentioned several times yesterday, and we start talking about major corridors, and here again, 460 is a major corridor in Virginia. Just to give you just a little bit of background, there was an initiative many, many years ago called the 460 corridor development, where it was the Commonwealth committed to four-laning 460 from the Tidewater area to Kentucky. I am proud to stand here in front of you today and announce that we are on the doorstep of completing that commitment to our citizens. We are within within several miles of completing that commitment, and this is a part of it. And here, with what I'm proposing today, and give you a little bit of background, is to an opportunity that we didn't think that we were going to have, that we do in fact have available to us. So without further ado, I'd like to move forward with that, to give you a little idea of the location of this phase two that we are talking about, of the 460 connector. Phase two begins about a mile east of the Kentucky line, moving east for about 6 miles. In that, it brings us within 6 miles of Grundy. And right now, 460 has been developed for a four-lane facility to the Grundy point. Phase one of the connector is presently under construction. With BizAC, major entrance or the entrance into Kentucky, all of this has been coordinated with Kentucky. I am glad to be able to announce that Kentucky will hopefully let their last project, which brings the 460 initiative in Kentucky to the Virginia line in 2010, with hopefully a completion in 2014. So with that, we are moving forward to give connectivity to a major corridor, not only for local but regional significance in moving goods and services in and out of Virginia intrastate with Kentucky. The proposed 460 will be on a new alignment. It is to provide a 12-foot travel lane with a 40-foot variable medium, all depending on what Mother Nature will be able to provide us. This is certainly rough terrain. Is probably some of the roughest terrain that we will have to deal with in road construction. The project is designated as a limited access roadway, and the new thing that we are entering into, the what we are proposing as far as the current relocation, will certainly give us an opportunity to take advantage of coal synergy. And when we say coal synergy, this is where we can partner with the coal producing companies in the area to supply and build a roadway, a roadbed for us at the same time. The Virginia Department of Transportation, received unsolicited proposal for phase two from Pioneer Incorporated. In 2008, FHWA approved VDOT to go ahead and look further into this proposal. the decision document and sole source determination and NEPA study. The decision document will include a mineral evaluation study that was completed in October of this past year. I know a lot of people wonder what we mean when we say coal synergy. So I'd like to try to explain a little bit about that to see where it's advantageous for VDOT to take advantage of that. Of course, with most of the time that you think of it, roadway construction is associated with required excavation quantity. With that, and a lot of times that is the major expense of any roadway construction. Needless to say, surface mining is also deals with that issue as far as cost. Coal company excavation costs are based on what they call an economic overburden to coal ratio, EOCR. And what the proposal is, and us being able to partner with and using this, the EOCR is the in-place cubic yards of overburden material that can be economically removed to recover a marketable ton of coal. Roadway excavation in excess of that would be paid for by VDOT. In other words, a coal company could come in, remove excavation to a certain level to get that coal, and then if additional excavation was needed, then we could partner with them to remove that. The real advantage of all of this is the large-scale earth-moving capabilities of the coal companies to reduce the excavation cost. And obviously, with that capability, they are able to enhance the schedule, quicken the pace of having the construction done. The project is tied to the development goals and objectives of two separate transportation initiatives. And we talked about Carter Q of the ADHS. And of course, the U.S. Route 460 and CFX. I need to explain to you. A lot of people have talked about CFX, Coalfield Expressway. We do have a portion of that under construction right now. However, what you need to understand that there is overlap of CFX, so the portion that is under construction right now is also a part of 460, which is a part of Carter Q. So we're tying it all together here. So right now, hopefully with the completion of what we call that portion, Hawk's Nest in the area, with completion of phase one, and then hopefully with the approval of the relocation of the alignment for phase two, we will basically be within about 10 miles of completing Carter Q in Southwest Virginia, and also completing living up to the commitment that we previously made for four-lane 460 from the East Coast to the Kentucky line. The existing project that we're talking about, phase two, is it's 6.7 miles, with 6.2 miles of this being roadway construction, and then about a half a mile that is the interchange with Hawk's Nest or the CFX. FHWA approved the environmental assessment for this location in March of this year. The logical termini has been provided and approved, which, and like I had said before, it's approximately 1 mile east of the Kentucky state line and brings us within approximately 6 miles west of the town of Grundy. VDOT recommends approval of the location of the U.S. 460 connector phase two for the following reasons. This will provide improved regional and local connectivity. We certainly have been needing that in our part of the world for a long time, and this certainly provides that opportunity. It is a vital link and needs to be done as far as part of the queue is concerned. And it matches very well with the U.S. 460 initiatives in Kentucky. 460 is, like many other roads, it certainly build a good transportation facility, and economic development will occur. The Appalachian Development Highway System was basically set up to encourage economic development in otherwise challenged areas of the country with, as far as development is concerned. Coal synergy is a plus in dealing with this because it certainly significantly reduces the cost of construction. And we are anticipating that with this new alignment that it will reduce cost by 40% and or $100 million, and that's a lot of money. Yeah, that can be used elsewhere along the corridor. A public hearing was held with 140 citizens attending locally, and of course at most of this at the public hearing they want to know, well, what does this do to my house? The plans have not been developed to the point with just looking at the corridor, so the individual impacts will be determined at a later time. However, we feel like that most of that can be addressed satisfactorily to everyone's satisfaction. Pending CTP approval of the location here today, with what we're asking, that will allow VDOT to move forward to complete the decision document for FHWA. It will also allow us to move forward to obtain sole source determination. And then when we say sole source determination, this is where the coal company would be the only one to build this roadway. And it would also give VDOT the authority to enter into heavy negotiations with Pioneer Group.
Mr. Burrell, can you get to your recommendation? I'm sorry, we have a very busy
agenda
today.
Yes, sir. I certainly will. Well, I've just made the recommendation that this be approved.
Wonderful. Are there questions or commentary? Mr. Billy.
Mr. Chairman, for the benefit of those not familiar with Carter Q, that's an area in Virginia among several states along the Appalachian region that is eligible for federal funds that are provided by the Appalachian Regional Commission, and they can be spent in Carter Q. The money is there, is available for this. And that same money could not be spent elsewhere in Virginia except in that particular area, which is called Carter Q.
Chairman.
Mr. King.
This is another area where this is a lifeline for the future of Southwest Virginia, and particularly Dickinson County and Buchanan County. Dickinson County is the county that doesn't have a single foot of four-lane road. This particular area is an area that Buchanan County and surrounding areas are looking for future help in terms of the advancements that are being made with
with the synergies of coal, we're looking at this redevelopment area here. They've mined the coal, but the reclamation is providing an opportunity for village development, for industrial development. A factory has already moved in there, actually a Sykes Center that is employing about 200 people now with good-paying jobs, with benefits. There's connectivity to Route 83, Virginia 83, that the county developed to VDOT standards, and that's the bottom part of this map here. This is a good project. It is one that takes that gives us a savings on the construction side. It's also an alternate for 460 that prevents two scars of the earth, if you will, because they're going to mine the coal. They're just going to do it in an environmentally acceptable way that leaves us a rough grade roadbed. They don't complete the road. They leave us a roadbed that is rough grade for this period of time. It has double utility. It connects us over to US 23, which is to the south, I-26. So it's a great project.
Okay. Any other questions, comments, Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, because Mr. Keene has covered the meat of what I was thinking. But I want to share with everybody that coal synergy has been the one bright spot that I found in my tenure here, something new, creative, out of the box, that actually provides funding. And it's the thing when talking to people from out of state that I actually get to smile and brag about what's going on down there with coal synergy.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. This is an action item, so Mr. Brittle, if you could stay for the action item. there's a very long history to this, and this coal synergy process, Governor Kane has dedicated $22 million in specific state grants to further this. It's a unique, very creative. Mr. Brittle's team, chief engineer, and others have made this business model work, and it's very important that we continue that. We'll have an opportunity during the business session. Okay, the next item on here is the Virginia Capital Trail, the Sherwood Forest phase. This is another location decision, and like the previous item, there is an action item today because of the timing associated with this. Mr. Hawthorne, welcome, and thank you for taking time out of your day to be with us.
Thank you, sir. I think I clicked on the wrong file.
Let's go back to that one again.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. It's a pleasure to be here. I hope this item will be much simpler than the last three location recommendations that you've heard over the past 2 days.
Depends on the quality and the speed of your presentation.
Sir, I'll try to be very speedy. My purpose here today is to ask for a decision on a location of a segment of the Virginia Capital Trail located in Charles City County. I'll start with an overview, a very quick overview of the project itself. The segment in question is the Sherwood Forest segment shown in, I think that's a beige color in the middle of Charles City County. If we start to the far right corner, the Green Springs phase and the Chickahominy phase shown in green and blue are complete. The next phase to the west is the one in question today. Moving to the west, there is a segment at the just east of the courthouse that is still in development, and we'll be bringing action to the board in a few months on that. The next segment to the west is the courthouse phase shown in purple. That segment is complete. The segment in blue and green, I think I said, were complete as well. Moving further to the west, those next segments in red and again in some sort of color of green are in development. And then finally, the furthest western segment is under construction today. So we're moving closer to completing a considerable portion of the trail in the Charles City County area. That's a summary of just what I covered. A more specific overview of the segment today. A location design public hearing was held on Wednesday, April 1st for the Sherwood Forest segment of the trail. The segment begins about 2.25 miles east of Charles City Courthouse and extends to about 0.4 mile west of the west bank of the Chickahominy River and ties in with the Chickahominy Riverfront phase that's already completed. Proposed project consists of about 10 miles of construction parallel to Route 5. There were 50 citizens in attendance at the public hearing in April. There was no opposition to the location of the trail in this particular area of Charles City County. And the graphic shows a depiction of the trail, a separate trail, multi-use trail, located adjacent to Route 5 on the north side of Route 5. The recommended trail location is on the north side of Route 5. That ties in with the trail that's already been completed across the new Judith Stewart Dresser Bridge, crossing the Chickahominy River. That particular location on the north side of Route 5 takes advantage of utility clearings and to minimize the tree loss and reduces the right-of-way impacts. Again, there was no opposition expressed to this particular location in Charles City County by the local residents. The action requested today is approval of the location for this particular phase of the Capitol Trail, and that would authorize VDOT to proceed with development and right-of-way acquisition for the trail in the very near future for that segment. Next steps, authorize right-of-way in spring of 2010, construction fall of 2010. This 10-mile segment is estimated to cost a total of about $9.2 million. And, gentlemen, that's the, Mr. Chairman, that's the end of my presentation. I'll be happy to take any
questions. Outstanding presentation. Ms. McCarthy?
I compliment my district administrator, Mr. Hawthorne, for another outstanding presentation. This is a great project. We've invested in it for several years now in direct appropriations and ARIF funds and enhancement funds, and it's we're rounding the final turn and heading for home, and it's just one of the most wonderful projects I think we've ever been involved in. So I hope you will join me in supporting this decision later on this morning.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments, Mr. Hawthorne? Okay, the final work session item is a very important update by the Commissioner on the refashioning and the reshaping of the Department of the Transportation in light of our long-term revenue situation. Welcome, Commissioner.
Good morning. We are handing out, as I'm starting here this morning, Mr. Chairman and members, the overheads that go with what I'm presenting this morning. I also would like to note that at each of your places, I think, is our quarterly report, so that we can, again, highlight for you that even in these times of transition within VDOT, we are continuing to hit our performance targets and goals that have been established in program and project delivery. I think that's a real testament to our department staff as they move forward and change the department and at the same time maintain a mission of delivery on projects and programs for the Commonwealth. What I'm going to visit with you this morning on actually three topics, kind of the final shape and form at a high level of the department of 2010 and beyond and what it will look like. I want to give you a status on stage two of our transition process and then give you a quick look into stage three that will be initiated in the first week of January. As you know, and as I've explained to the board previously, this entire process is really a design-build activity so that we could expedite the transition as we responded to the organizational directions in the downturn of the economy. The parts are now together. We see the end state in sight, and so I want to highlight for you some of that this morning. Again, as I have done on virtually all occasions, remind the board and remind those that we are working with that what we are engaged in and what we have done yesterday and again today is discussing three parts of what puts the total package together. Those discussions that we have around the six-year program, those discussions and changes that we make in our program and service mix that the department delivers, and then lastly, the department's organization and staffing pattern as we move forward. As you think about this part of what we're doing, the organization and staffing piece, the challenge has been for the staff as we look to the future to respond to and reflect the changes made in a six-year program and the service mix and goals established to anticipate the and prepare for that uncertain future around those two elements and to live and reflect the mission drivers of the department. And that's why I started on that front end piece. If you look at our mission statement, it is about planning, operating and maintaining and delivering projects as the driver of our mission. And lastly, we are obviously focused in an organization that is to be designed to balance efficiency and effective business practices. As you look at where we are, and I wanted to just recap for you what's really shaping this organization as we move from into 2010 and beyond. First and most important, and I've highlighted this in previous presentations, 15 years of reviews and directions to structure an effective and sustainable agency for our future. Historically, if you look back to 1992, it was a watershed year for transportation in the country. It was watershed for two particular reasons. First, Congress determined that the interstate system, the major public works driver for DOTs across the country, was complete and finished. And they signaled a new era in direction for DOTs when they passed ICE-T, that first of the T bills. That shifted our focus from that singular vision of construction and completion of a system of 42,000 miles of road across the country to one that would more focus on maintenance and operations, performance management, a greater focus on local engagement, and a shift in the planning responsibilities across the country, illustrated very powerfully yesterday by our discussions and debate around the 29 corridor. The second major driving force as we moved forward in this activity since last October when this was launched was what was embodied in the Appropriation Act. And I have excerpted the five key bullets that I keep coming back to as driving forces as we shape the blueprint. 7,500 classified positions as our target for June of 2010. A reduction and consolidation of our facilities and organizational units by approximately 30%. A streamlining of our management and organization and supervisory structure within the department. And an admonition to ensure that our focus is on maintenance and operations of the existing infrastructure with a focus toward emergency response, congestion mitigation, pavement rehabilitation and bridge repair, and to ensure that as we move forward, we maintain that mix of private sector utilization by the department. I've captured it this way for our organizational design process, driven by a mission that is about planning, operating and maintaining, and delivering an a transportation system that focuses on safety and deals with and enhances the economy and improves quality of life. Those are hard balances, but as we've looked at safety around emergency operations, and I'll highlight just last week, the department staff was out preparing the Commonwealth for winter season. And people see in a very tangible way that focus then on emergency response as it's visited and getting ready for winter. I did note several newspaper articles that recognized that priority, which I thought was important. But that translates into these six driving forces. An agency that is focused on a mission, core mission, around maintenance, operations, emergency response, that we recognize in our business that a project is a project. That is, whether it's driven by maintenance funding or whether it's driven by construction funding, the process and the staff that we use is the same staff to deliver those projects. And a tightening around our universal general administration. We have a scaled set of services that has, as we discussed it last February, we talked very significantly about our operational practices in our 18 service areas and the priorities around those, which led to the fiscal year 10 budget adjustment and the priorities that were established. Second or third, a business model that focuses on the values of the mission statement and integrates and streamlines our business through the use of partnerships and does not replicate every function and every service throughout the department's organization. I'll come back to that in a minute. Fourth, what we've talked about significantly, and that is rapid deployment of new practices and technology through using research and using our best practices. We've illustrated that over the last year and a half through the use of our anti-icing initiative in the department. Fully deployed statewide, used based on a research model that was developed through our research council and deployed statewide in the space of 8 months. Implementable last winter, enhanced for this winter, and brings about real savings in terms of operational practices and costs. Next we needed to recognize that the future of our construction funding will be focused on safety, reconstruction, and bridge replacement, and that new major construction will be episodic as we move forward. I think that discussion yesterday was highly illustrative of that. And lastly, the outcome, which is a VDOT that is smaller, that does provide its services differently than we have been since 1932, and that we are necessarily proportioned differently. I use this illustration for a purpose. Everybody looks at it and says, well, I didn't have colors in it when I started, but some of the staff has added some colors to it. And I did this because I wanted to contrast it against an organizational chart I showed you in October of 2008. If you recall that 1932 organizational chart, it was based on a geographic model of organization. Everything replicated everywhere through our residency system. The transformation that is going on and has been going on for the last 15 years is a focused organization around function. These three functions or four functions really represent what our mission statement says. We are focused at maintenance and operations and system management. We are driven by planning, policy, funding, and finance, and we deliver our projects through a strong program and project development and management philosophy. We tie that together through our administration and business support. And the art form has been to bring that together in a real model that works for the Commonwealth.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir, Mr.
Would
Dr.
the Commission
Davis.
Like any feedback, or do we... What the listeners
let's let Commissioner finish his presentation, please.
As we now look toward July 2010 with those driving forces, what you see listed in this chart, and this is my high-level way of showing you proportions against our mission statement, you will see that planning, programming, finance, research will comprise about 490 positions within the department. Our project development and delivery system will be focused around about 1,460 staff. Our maintenance and operations focus will be around 4,560 staff. And our business support, the internal work that we do to support the organization, will and the special functions that we need to carry out will total to about 920, which brings our organizational target within reach at about 7,430 positions as you see it. We have developed this model and this proportioning of the organization in stages through a significant amount of dialogue within the department, quite a bit of debate, the influence from the conversations throughout the Commonwealth, not without some disagreement within the organization and around us as we've moved forward, and we heard that in our public hearings last March, but it has driven to a resolution and a direction. Recognizing where we need to be as an organization. What does it mean? What it means in terms of this organizational direction says a core shape, and as I've explained in the past, our core around the area headquarters at 181, we are streamlining to a 29 maintenance area headquarters structure. We have reduced this summer to 37 equipment facilities. We will have 5 operations centers. The core of the department will focus around our 9 districts, the Virginia Research Council, and our central office. When you contrast this to where we were pre-2006, if you add this up about right and look at facility locations, prior to about 2006, you would find us located at about 520 locations around the Commonwealth. With this model, you will see us at about 270 locations across the Commonwealth. Why is that possible? As we talked about in the area headquarters consolidation in 2006, it's brought about by modernized equipment. It's brought about by the improvement in technology and the improvement in practices from where we were in the 1950s and 1960s. You will see our staff proportioned on the second column about this way. When you go back and look, we have maximized our frontline maintenance and operations staff, those people that do day-to-day services and emergency response, in that 3,400 range, our operations staff at around 550, tunnels, ferries, and tolls at about 400, our bridge inspection, maintenance, and design staff at about 440, project development, as I showed you previously, at about 1,470, about 280 staff devoted to planning, and program management, research and education at 90, and our business functions, if you look at all of those things that we need to do for inventory, procurement, the things that keep the business running day in, the human resource piece, at about 800 staff. What does this mean as we look forward and look to that, and how does it change the way we do business? I do believe that this organizational design focuses at our core mission of system maintenance and operations. It does remodel and change the way we think about planning and investment management, and it scales our project development and delivery. We will have about 86% of our staff in the field. That is a slight increase from where we were proportionally in 2003. About 62% of our staff will be focused at maintenance and operations, about 19% focused at developing and delivering projects, and about 10% in general administration. I think the organization will preserve maintenance and emergency response mission, and it will add more staffing to teams in the field in these areas. That is a classification and staffing of our area headquarters. It maintains our commitment to bridge inspection and repair. It streamlines the way we deliver projects and in our development services. We have made some tough choices about regionalizing some of our functions that should not be duplicated everywhere, every place. I illustrate that with our right-of-way function. It strengthens our programming process at the district level. That's an important point as we move forward in managing six-year plans and managing investments at the district level. It uses PPTA and design build as a method to expedite projects and facilitates that. And it will look to a change in our customer service model from area headquarters is where you call to get service or residencies to using our transportation operations center, those five facilities that we have across the Commonwealth, to collect and distribute work orders and or emergency response calls. That's built very much on the utility model that is used by Virginia Utilities and has proved to be very successful. We're also emphasizing planning and investment management across all programs and funding sources. As we do that at the district level by strengthening our planning, the expectation is that our district administrators will be much more enabled to balance and use their dollars across various programs as opposed to thinking about them in stovepipes. That is what strengthening that planning operation is all about in the field. It proportions our project development to match, our staffing to match the size of a reduced program and recognize its episodic nature. We are creating an organization that is scalable and balances program size by effective use of private sector outsourcing. So we have not built an organization that can be independent. We are increasing the accountability at the district level, and we've talked about that a lot this morning in terms of focusing planning and investment decision making at the district level to more closely link land use and spending decisions from a regional point of view. That is, in fact, pulling a lot of that activity that used to go on in our residencies back to the district office, so that the district can take a much broader view of all of those demands and needs within the areas they serve. We also allows new ways within our district offices and within our regions to be able to improve our liaison approach with local units of government to improve consistency in our decision making. And it streamlines our decision making by reducing layers of management. We have, in the design of the organization, focused clearly at what is a true full-time supervisor, not just a crew leader. So we are clearly differentiating that expertise that is necessary. The plan does achieve the 7,500 level. It does reduce and consolidate our facilities and organizational units by the goals established. We will have a core focused division structure within our central office at about 22. There will be 29 residency locations. That's the structure and the 15 that we will be consolidating. We have already implemented the 37 equipment and repair facility system across in stage two. We are relatively close within that five layers. There are still some areas within the department that we cannot achieve that at this stage, but we will get there. We maintain our focus on emergency response, pavement rehabilitation, bridge repair, and by all measures, we will maintain that contractual spending and utilization of the private sector at that 70% level as we move forward. That's conscious in our design of the organization. As I said, we've been moving, and when we finish, we'll come back to questions. But as we've been moving, I should go back real quickly. I want to make sure that everybody understands that the plan as we move forward is a living plan. I've emphasized that in every briefing to the board. No plan is perfect, so it needs and is designed to be able to be adjusted as we learn and continue to discover where there is some adjustment necessary. And that will continue through July of next year. Stage two, as I briefed you in July, was focused around the first stage of our classified employees. As you recall, back in June, we dealt with the wage employees and implemented that first stage. We conducted the separation activities to occur in September and October, and they officially ended the 1st of November. And as I indicated at the time, these were the functions that were driven in that second stage, or that were reviewed in that second stage. In July, we provided 640 notices to employees across the Commonwealth, and you can see how they were proportioned in this beginning, in the left-hand column that you see. As of November 1st, 529 staff left the agency. 272 chose not to request placement within our organization because, as I explained the process that we're going through, we're driven by finding placement opportunities before people exit the organization. That's where the substitution process, where employees were able to identify for themselves that they were willing to be laid off as a part of this, and that's 224 substitutes were used in that stage two. We could not find placement for 12 people, and 29 people declined placement or resigned. 21. That second bullet is about those people that did request placement in the process. 368. We found placements through vacancies or substitution for 333 people in this process. 12 are the 12 we could not place, and 23 were not placed for other reasons. They declined offers, and that changes in the process. As I indicated in October, I thought this was a tremendously successful part of our initiative. It has done much, I hope, to reduce the fear of the transitions that are necessary in our business as we place emphasis on the importance of our people in this organization. Stage three is now geared to begin in January, first week of January of 2010. Different than stage two, it will not be driven in two phases. It will only have one termination date or out date for employees, which is in April. The focus of that stage three transition will now be the residency consolidation, our maintenance and operations adjustments that we're making, our business support and administrative consolidations across the Commonwealth, and within our central functions, the list of functions that you see listed underneath that bullet point. Final thoughts as we open it up to questions. This organization will necessarily be different and look different than it did as an organization of 10,000 employees back in 2003. This organization will, as we've designed it or proposed, laid it out, will emphasize service, performance, quick decision-making, and on-time and on-budget performance over bureaucratic process and paperwork. We will operate and maintain the road network for the Commonwealth using the best mix of staff, private sector resources, technology for emergency response, safety, and customer service, driving core mission. The organization will link good planning with sound spending at the local level and focus around achieving performance standards as the board is articulating them and community goals. I think the organization, as it's designed, is strong for today and will allow us now to adapt for an unpredictable future. The organization, based on system size, will probably be one of the most effective in the country when you start to compare, which is what is going on throughout the country. I can tell you that over the last 3 months, a minimum of 6 other states are now experiencing what we initiated last October and have in fact looked to us for some guidance on how to approach this kind of a transition. This organization and staffing approach does in fact, I believe, create opportunities and career potential as a professionally driven organization. And my last thought is I've tried to sit back and reflect on this organizational design is it's almost like a new computer operating system, if you think about it. It has much unrealized new feature and efficiency and effectiveness, but it takes some time to get used to it and to adjust to it. And those of us who move from Vista to Windows 7 will take some time, and some of us will try to make Windows 7 work like Vista. But as we discover the power of the organization, we will adjust our practices to match and utilize the full capacity of what this organizational staffing pattern gives us. With that, I'll open it up to questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, not a question, but a comment. I'd like to commend Mr. Eckern and his staff for doing what I consider to be a superb job of redesigning and reorganizing. It's caused a lot of pain and anxiety, but what a difficult task that has been to take a bureaucratic organization put together over nearly 8 decades and redesign it, reorganize it, in the manner that has been done in a relatively short time. I think the end result is going to be a much more effective, much more efficient organization. It'll be ongoing. It isn't perfect, but as Mr. Eckern says, it will be fine-tuned as time goes on. And probably a very important factor in making this possible has been our financial plight. I suspect that without the financial difficulties, it probably would not have, probably could not have been redesigned as it has been, but this made it necessary. And Mr. Commissioner, you've done an excellent job. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bowie.
Thank you, Mr. Bowie. Mr. Martin.
One comment, one question. Actually, one suggestion, one comment. On slide 13, where you refer to central function consolidations to
caution you to please, at least on the one I'm thinking of, don't let the consolidation evolve into an elimination on equal opportunity business and employment opportunities, both internally and externally. And the comment is, when I first heard about the substitution model, I was, as a human resource type, all happy to hear about that. But I'm really happy to find out how well it works. I commend you.
Thank you. That took a lot of work on a lot of people's part to get implemented.
Mr. Chairman, I would add my compliments and thanks as well. Reducing the size of an organization or changing the focus is never easy. So I compliment the commissioner there, but I want to offer him a little help, and I know this will scare him to death probably. I think there is one flaw that I have identified as I listened to the detail that he shared, and I want to point it out because I think all this discussion with VTrans over the last several weeks sort of brought it to my forefront. And the flaw is that there are two things that are not diminishing that demand that we have an organization and a structure that help address it. And that is, population is not decreasing in Virginia. The economy cannot go backward in Virginia. It has to go forward. And I didn't hear very much in here about who's going to address their attention to those needs that were described in our VTrans document as the mega projects and the mega thinking that has to be done and has to be presented to the public, the General Assembly, and to the general public to help them understand that we still do not have a completed transportation system. And I heard those words used, and that bothers me tremendously. And secondly, that we're going to focus all new construction on reconstruction and repair. We cannot do that. So somewhere in this organization, we have to provide for the future of being able to address the things that still need to be done, not only in the Commonwealth, but I would argue that nationally, the same thinking has to be there. And what has happened is the funding requirements that have put us in this mess that we're in, that brought about some of the fundamental changes that are good, has caused us to dig a hole and not look out of the foxhole and know that one of these days we've got to come out of the foxhole and continue to deal with the challenges that are there for us. And that's what VTrans helped me see more clearly the other day as we were all talking. So I would hate to think, Mr. Commissioner, I'm offering help. We need to not lose sight that that's still a vital, important function, and we've got to have staff and structure to carry that on. And I didn't hear much of that in this presentation, but I do appreciate the work that's been done to get us where we are.
I'm sure the Secretary is going to want to comment on this also, but two pieces that hopefully will give you some hope that, as I started, I said we needed to be able to anticipate a future, an uncertain future. And part of what I showed you is a strengthening and actually a reproportioning of the organization to increase our focus on planning, finance, which opens the door for us to reflect for you as a board your decisions around a six-year investment program, a long-range VTrans plan, and the service mix that you want us to provide.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, I applaud what you've done, but I would say I didn't hear anything in this update that made me feel comfortable that we have our eyes on the future, and I just want to be sure that we try to keep our eyes on the future while we deal with current reality, because I think that's our hope.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, there was a question over here. Ms. Carter.
A question, a comment. Do many of you all watch Dancing with the Stars? And when one disagrees and one says this, I say, fantastic, wonderful. That's how they do that?
Thank you.
I just want to say there were five, that you said, that we realized the importance of our people. Thank you so much for those comments. You have shown this throughout your substitution vacancy replacement, and you all have kept your eyes, Mr. Secretary, and Mr. Commissioner, you have kept your eyes on the importance of people. And that's what I don't see happening in so many of the industries in Congress and wherever. So I would say this, that you said about six states have come to you. I think maybe Congress needs to come down too. But however, I know that you all have done a fantastic job, and I applaud you, and thank you so much for looking out for the people. And so it's wonderful. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, just to add one area that hasn't diminished here to part of what Dr. Davis has said, I don't see miles decreasing in our system, being the third largest system in the country. And I don't see bridges that are deteriorating decreasing, and so I know that the structure's got to be in place to take care of that as we look also to enhance expansion. The other thing, I think we're, and I'd have to agree that it is a good job, but we're incorporating some decentralization as well as some centralization into a plan here that's really to take care of the system that exists. And as part of that, we also beginning to hold the districts a little bit more accountable from decision-making and process. But what concerns me about that is also that there's a reduction of force in that area to do more. So we're going to do more with less on a level, even in the district side. And certainly, I think that's important that the right staff be in place for that particular function. But the numbers are there to take care of the field work that's got to take place. And I'm a little bit afraid that, you know, the law of diminishing returns can take over on some of the cuts. And we get out there and cut too far. And I know it's out of necessity, but we still got to say it, because somewhere along the line, we're going to have to pay for it. And what we're talking about here, and the reason we're talking about that, is the lack of proper revenues to take care of a 57,000-mile system. Somebody will have to face that. This board's probably not going to be able to do that for what period of time we had to serve here. But we've got to do like Dr. Davis says, put it on the table. It's got to have more money. And if you want to use Jerry McCarthy's example of you pay more for coffee than you do to maintain 57,000 miles of road, and I've used it now numerous of times in presentations that you make back in the community, and let me tell you, it gets their attention. The first thing you open with is to tell them, you guys are paying more for coffee than you are to maintain the third largest system. It gets everybody's attention. Then when you give them an example, they agree. We all pay more for coffee. But it's got to be put on the table. We've got to recognize you're dealing with the immediate budget that we have. The system has to go on. The baby's here, and we've got to take care of it.
Ms. Pandit.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with all the comments that have been said, and I'd add two things. One, I think it's real important to make sure that there's going to be continued very constructive and constant supervision of the private sector component here, that in order to effectively use the public dollars that will either match or otherwise be a part of the process. And then secondly, we need to figure out how to convince people that the change is here, as opposed to the view that perhaps people use it, that you keep looking in the mirror and you think you're seeing the same entity when in fact that entity has changed quite a bit. And I think that's been something that's plagued the department over the last couple of years. It needs to be in a very perhaps clear one-page way conveyed to the public that it is a different creature that they have now and that's taking us into the future. And you're not going to find multi-millions and billions of dollars within this structure to fund what needs to be done.
Good. Excellent points. Mr. Coulomb.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I like very much the building in of efficiencies. I think that was something that we were all concerned with, and even more so as the months went on. But also your reference to flexibility of the organization, the ability to be responsive regardless of what the future brings, I think that's one thing that we need to understand very deeply, is that is probably going to be your chief characteristic of success, because the future is not just going to settle down and be nice and predictable again, and we just live in different times. I have a question about the inherent tension between, at the district level and the central office level. If you're pushing decision-making down to the districts, doesn't that challenge state priorities, for example, that we've been talking about? After reading the 29 draft report last night, I was thinking we should retitle it the 29s, and each piece would get its own chapter. But the second is, by emphasizing district-level activity, are we emphasizing subsystem development as opposed to whole system development? And I know you're aware of those things. Do you have any additional thoughts about that, what transition issues there are there?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cooley, yes, I do. The conscious design of our central function was, in fact, to have the central function focused at process, programs, systems, and exactly what we've tried to illustrate with the Route 29 study. There are corridors that cross multiple boundaries and therefore need to have a focus, and we provide that service through our central function, which brings together district planning. What it does is it allows district planning then to complement, supplement, and really control the majority of the system within the Commonwealth. So by conscious design, that's the transformation that we now move into. Early on, I talked to you about size, number of people, structure of the department, dealing with our people, and now the focus, which is what we used to call process reform, all of those business practices. That's clearly, I'm already starting to see managers asking those questions. How does this work? Can we change this to make that work? So I think I'm pretty happy as I can be with the now emerging questions. And so I think that's how we're addressing where you're headed.
A second question, Mr. Chairman. And in your chart of on the slide 7, you obviously talk about the changes and what the now the core shape looks like. And it's smaller. It's focused in a different way. But there's one static piece there, and that's the 9 districts. We've discussed before that, for example, the Northern Virginia district by population, one measure of size is bigger than 5 other districts combined. Does that give you the balance that you need within the district level? Do we have too many? Do we need more? I mean, as you shove things down, you're beginning to run into some real different scale. Let's call it scope and scale of what that job really is in
different
districts.
That's an interesting question, because part of what I was talking about is, in an organization like a transportation agency, a part of this is art form. It's not all science and it's not all numbers. And the real dynamic that's going on in slide 7 is a pull and a push. Pull from, quote, the 1932 model, which was residency-based, everything replicated in 92 places, and a push from a central function so that you are not a totally centralized organization, which is the most efficient. So if you really wanted to have the absolute efficient model, I can centralize this department and run everything from Richmond. What does that do? It destroys customer service. It destroys local level planning and connections. So 9, I believe, is the unit that has stood the test of time. And in fact, as we've looked at operations and maintenance, we're readjusting on a path that you could have gone down to say 9 stands the test. A previous commissioner changed the reportability of district administrators to the commissioner. He did that for a reason. And the reason was to clearly communicate to the customer that there's a direct connection between my office and what goes on at the local area. In most DOTs, you will find the district administrator at least 2 layers down in the organization, as it was here prior to 2002. I consciously chose not to change that, because at one point people look at you, and I get a lot of advice, you know, you can't handle more than 4 direct reports. I ask first-line supervisors to manage 15 to 20 people. This is not an unsophisticated business, and I think we send the right message by maintaining what was done well in previous administrations and continuing that forward. And I think the 9-district method does that.
One final observation, Mr. Chairman, is that the size of the challenge as well as the population in Northern Virginia actually has worked to break down some of the parochialism of specific localities. It's actually helped focus the region on regional connections and regional projects and regional benefits. And while it's not nearly so perfect, I would just say that considering the scope and size of districts might be a strategy as well going forward, just from a policy perspective, about how do we get the emphasis at the right level to accomplish the right things for regions of the Commonwealth, because that's ultimately what transportation is. It's actually a regional and area-wide kind of a function.
Mr. McCarthy.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, members of the board, I would add my congratulations to Commissioner Eckern for a very effective job in a very difficult circumstance. Not only is he deprived of money to do what we all think needs to be done, but let's not forget that it was the General Assembly that said you will reduce to 7,500 employees. You will have no more than 5 layers of administration. You will consolidate the residency offices. You will consolidate the equipment and repair facilities. This is a lot of very prescriptive language in an Appropriations Act to direct a state highway roads transportation commissioner how to shape his organization. And to his credit, he has managed not to weaken the organization by doing what he has done and presented over the last 13 months to us. I also point out that it was the General Assembly that came up with the VTrans 2025 direction to us and VTrans 2035, and to produce visionary long-range plans for a transportation system for the 21st century that is not only multimodal but multifunctional, and that will produce the kind of movement of people and goods and delivery of services that everybody dreams we ought to have in a very perfect world. My own sense here is that I'm not sure whether it's our responsibility or the General Assembly's responsibility, or whether we should be telling the General Assembly that there is the possibility of a disconnect between those two jobs that we all have been given, and the disconnect possibly arising from the fact that at least most of the General Assembly members I know are disappointed that we're cutting projects out. They're disappointed that we're not adding new projects. And whenever I point out, as James so nicely reminded me, that it's cheaper to buy a cup of coffee than the average Virginian pays to maintain and improve this system, I have a difficult time gaining traction with that argument, because there's a disconnect between the desire for more projects, more moving dirt, getting it done faster, getting jobs created, and the downsizing of the principal organization tasked with doing that. And so I want to make this disconnect obvious. I hope, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, Mr. Commissioner, that I am doing that, because until we deal with the disconnect between a growing population in a state that prides itself on being the best for business in the country, and whose number one job of every governor is creating more jobs, that implies to me they want to expand a transportation system that functions to make those jobs possible and effective and productive and so on and so forth. Well, you know, somewhere along the line where the rubber meets the road, potholes are not free. You know, we have to find the money to fund that disconnect, because I really see it as a real serious problem going forward. The desire for all that V-Trans says we want and the General Assembly says they want with what we are actually able to deliver, that disconnect is a real one, and I don't know if we could solve that one by next month, Mr. Chairman, but I want to lay it out there as the heart of the problem the next administration and the one after that is going to face, because if they do not come to grips with that disconnect with real money somehow to close that gap, it's all just hallucination what they're talking about with V-Trans 2035. It's like Governor Warner did when he came in and found $3 billion worth of projects that didn't have a nickel assigned to them or a prayer in heaven for getting done. And so they were dismissed. So one way of resolving this disconnect is to say, you know what, we're going to do exactly what you told us to do on the operational side with this reduced agency and reduced money, and we'll do the absolute best we can to maintain the existing system where new projects will be episodic at best, and thank you, but that's all we're able to do. And why don't we just drop this fiction of 2035, because you clearly aren't interested in funding it. So I hope if we can get nothing else across, we can get the message that there's a disconnect between what they say they want in the long run and the reality of what we are able to deliver in the short run.
Amen.
Thank you.
Mr. Lane, last follow up to that, short, brief, final word.
Yeah, brief final. I think the chairman, the commissioner has hit on that and your model for utility, looking at that, because if we could simply get the allocation of revenues to transportation the way utilities do, I think we would accomplish what Mr. McCarthy's talking about over there. But the comment I would have, just this is sort of detailed, on the call centers where you're outsourcing using the utility model, are they our employees, or are you looking at outsourcing those centers?
We have, as we've set that up in our operations centers, those are opportunities for employees within the department, because if they're knowledgeable about the system, it makes that call center work even better.
I'm just cautioning, when you outsource, if they don't understand, they're considered our employees, yet if they don't understand our system, we get the backlash because of that.
Okay, Commissioner, I think there's a universal a sense of appreciation for the very difficult task you and your down to every layer of this organization have undertaken over the last year. If you think about it, an organization that's emerged by topsy over 85, 87 years, you have spent a year analyzing, researching, thinking, dialoguing, to make this work, and so all of us extend a very sincere and heartfelt thanks for that. This is for an organization of this size, and I think sometimes we forget we're the third largest highway system in America, one of the largest in the world. To undertake this in this way is a tribute to the dedication and professionalism of everybody at VDOT. So thank you very much.
On behalf of everybody who has argued, struggled, had ideas, been frustrated, I thank the board for your support of us as we work through this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.